reflect the irrevocable differences between your points of view?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I believe the answer to that is a definite yes. We have spent 8 to 10 hours in negotiations. I feel I've been in the middle of this situation, trying to bring the manufacturers and the consumer groups together. We have a bill, I believe, in Amendments-6 that we can live with, the manufacturers can live with, and quite frankly, I believe it solves the consumer interest problems as they perceive them.
Further questions for me? No? Okay, Nick, thank you. Thank you, Bob. John Steuben for?
Good afternoon, Chairman Reichen, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to again testify before the House Business and Consumer Affairs Committee. With me today is Nivette Bowen, a student at Willamette University and a member of the Board of Directors of OSPIRG. For the record, my name is John Steubenval. I'm an organizer and the acting director of the Oregon Student Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. OSPIRG is a student-directed, student-funded organization dedicated to consumer protection, environmental preservation, good government, and social justice in Oregon. OSPIRG believes that HB 2793, as originally written, is in need of revision. We therefore fully support HB 2793-7 as now presented. In this testimony, I would like to briefly address three specific points which OSPIRG feels are of particular importance.
Sir, may I interrupt you here? We heard testimony before. What we want to know is how you comment on the proposed amendments by the industry.
Yeah, Chairman Reichen, I'll address that in my testimony.
Okay, you just said now that you support -7.
Yes, we do.
The ones we just had presented to us were -6.
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct. In this testimony, I would like to briefly address three specific points which OSPIRG feels are of particular importance. Those points being calendar days versus business days, the inclusion of attorney's fees and court costs, and the wording of Section 3, Subsection 1A. Calendar days versus business days. As provided in Section 4, Subsection 1B of HB 2793-7, a new motor vehicle shall be deemed defective if it has been out of service for repair for a cumulative total of 30 or more calendar days. In contrast, HB 2793-6 stipulates that a new motor vehicle is not defective until this cumulative total exceeds 30 business days. Under the language of Amendment 6, the consumer would lose approximately 110 days, as these non-business days would not count toward the 30-day cumulative total. In other words, a new motor vehicle could be out of service for up to 139 days during its first year of ownership and still not be classified as defective. Statistically, 139 days is over 38% of a calendar year. OSPIRG feels that this is too long a time period to be fair to the consumer.
Can I interrupt? I'm sorry, but I'm having a little trouble coming from 22 work days to 30 work days as being 139 difference.
No, I'm sorry. The difference was between calendar days and business days.
I recognize. If we had 30 calendar days, you have approximately 22 working days.
Yes.
Okay. As compared to 30 working days, what was the difference between the two?
The exact language is that if the business day language were used, the consumer would not be able to count approximately 110 non-business days per year in that cumulative total.
Representative Bennett, maybe I'll ask.
Go ahead.
I still don't, along with Representative Jones, quite understand that, because the limit appears to be, just to make sure I'm on the right line,
fine.
I may be missing this because I'm having trouble following both copies, but the vehicle is out of service by reason of repair or correction for a cumulative total of 30 or more days.
Yes, that's Amendment 7.
Okay. It would seem like we're dealing with a base of 30 then, rather than...
Right.
I'm trying to figure out what multiplier you're using to arrive at your 100.
Right. The difference is in Amendment 6, as proposed, the language is business days.
Right.
In that case, things like Saturdays and Sundays, Christmas, legal holidays, do not count. Those days add up to approximately 110 days per year. Out of the entire calendar year, yes.
Ms. Chairman, I was thinking we're working with a 30-day block here, not a calendar year block, is where I'm confused. See, it says the vehicle is out of service by reason of repair or correction for a cumulative total of 30 or more days. And I was thinking we were working within a 30-day block. You're saying that my car could be in the repair shop for a full year, and I would lose 120 days by that language change. Is that kind of how it works?
No, it doesn't make any difference if your car is in the shop or not.
Okay.
The fact remains that under the language of Amendment 6, those Saturdays and Sundays and legal holidays would not be eligible to be counted in as part of the 30-day cumulative total.
Right, so we're talking about 2, 4, 6, 8 days, maybe 9, 4.3 weeks.
No, we're talking about an entire calendar year. The language stipulates that a 30-day period during the first year of ownership.
Huh. I'm confused enough that number 6 looks reasonable to me. That's how confused I am.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, again, I guess to reiterate, is that the language states that during the first year of ownership, Amendment 6 states that the car has to be in the shop for 30 business days or more. Amendment 7 states 30 calendar days or more. The difference in a one-year period, the difference between business days and calendar days amounts to approximately 110 days out of the entire calendar year. Okay. The wording of Section 3, Subsection 1A. Section 3 of both proposed amendments lists the manufacturer's responsibilities if a new motor vehicle is legally defective. Subsection 1A of that section gives the option of replacing the defective vehicle with another comparable vehicle. Osberg supports the wording of Section 3 in HB 2793-7. We feel that it is important to clearly state that a consumer shall receive another new and unused vehicle if the original new vehicle is defective. It would be unjust for a consumer to receive a used vehicle as compensation for a defective new vehicle. When an Oregonian seeks to purchase and own a new vehicle, it is vital that our statutes ensure that the consumer receives a new and unused vehicle for his or her money. It would be equally unjust for a manufacturer to be forced to replace a defective vehicle which has incurred substantial use and mileage. This potential difficulty is provided for, however, with the option available under Section 3, Subsection 1B. That subsection gives the manufacturer the ability to refund the purchase price of a defective vehicle less an allowance for the consumer's use of the vehicle. Thus, a defective vehicle which has incurred substantial use and mileage would not have to be replaced with a new vehicle. Attorney fees and court costs. HB 2793-7 includes provisions whereby a consumer who successfully brings action under this statute can be awarded the attorney fees and court costs incurred in bringing action. Osberg strongly supports this awarding of attorney fees and court costs. The buyer of a new motor vehicle in Oregon should be able to expect a working, functional vehicle for its purchase price.
On the attorney fee, would you then go for an amendment to the prevailing party?
That's something we discussed in the negotiations, which Mr. Keister alluded to, and no consensus was arrived at that point.
Well, I will tell you, I won't support any bill that has this type of attorney fee in it. And if we take that type of provision to the House floor, we're going to have some real problems passing the whole bill with that in it. So I think you should be aware of that.
No, we certainly understand the concerns of the automobile industry, but we feel it's important that a consumer who may be a very low-income individual...
Well, now they're not going to be too low-income if they're bought a new car.
Right, right. But a person who is a low-income individual but still has the ability to own a new motor vehicle, feel it's important that that person have the ability to bring suit if indeed this bill is passed.
So you're open to prevailing party?
Well, we're certainly open to more negotiations at this point, yes.
Thank you.
The buyer of a new motor vehicle in Oregon should be able to expect a working, functional vehicle for its purchase price. When the vehicle turns out to be defective, however, the consumer must then pay out additional monies in seeking recourse. Further, the consumer must invest much of her or his time in attempting to get redress, time which is often lost from work, resulting in additional monetary expense. Our present-day legal system is filled with fine print, unfamiliar to the citizen not trained in law. You know, even though unfamiliar with it, the average Oregonian must rely for lawful remedy on our legal system, with all of its high-priced attorneys and court costs. These fees and court costs often total hundreds of dollars. It should be the purpose of a legal system to bring equitable restitution. For the purchase price of a new motor vehicle, the consumer should receive a vehicle which complies to all express and implied warranties. If the vehicle does not so comply, the consumer should then receive compensation without having to incur additional cost. In conclusion, real briefly, we live in a highly advanced technical age. With all these technological advancements, however, comes a certain number of defective units. In fact, a manufacturer's quality controls are designed to allow a small percentage of defective units to go undetected. The consumer should not have to suffer or pay for these defective vehicles. HB 2793 would ensure that the consumer does not so pay for these defective vehicles. A Lemon Law, as best embodied in HB 2793, would also help to restore consumer confidence in the automobile industry. If a consumer knows that he or she will receive a fully functional vehicle, either through initial purchase or through replacement of a defective vehicle, the consumer will be assured in the initial purchase and more inclined to make that initial purchase. This can only be beneficial for the industry. Osberg hopes that the Business and Consumer Affairs Committee will give HB 2793-7 its full consideration and pass the bill onto the House for floor debate. Thank you.
Question, Representative Gill.
Question regarding the attorney's fees. Can you tell me currently what provisions the law has in Oregon for awarding attorney's fees?
Right. I'm not an attorney, so I'm not up on all the legalese, but it's my understanding that there are certain provisions for the awarding of attorney's fees. The problem as we see it is that it's not clear whether under the HB 2793-6 as currently proposed, it's not clear whether a prevailing plaintiff in a suit would be able to ask for the awarding of attorney's fees if it's not specifically spelled out in amendment as it is not in Amendment 6.
Well, as I understand, the whole bill, though, is not looking at the legal process, but rather a way to allow remedy without a legal process.
Yeah, that,
so
yes,
why would we
correct.
Want to address attorney's fees in a bill that's trying to prevent that?
Because there will be times, as you say, there is the provision for the third-party arbitration process, which is written into to Amendment 6 and 7. Has been in the case in Connecticut and California, and Montana, the three states with now which have Lemon Laws. Most cases brought under those statutes are settled in that arbitration process. Unfortunately, there has been to date one case, that's been a case in Connecticut, which has not been settled through this arbitration process. So there will be a small number of cases which cannot be settled in that informal arbitration process.
But if I may, Mr. Chairman, I guess my point, though, is that this bill and the provision of the Lemon Law is not addressing the court cases. The court cases can still take place as they can today. What it is addressing is the process to prevent court action
yes.
from being necessary.
Yes.
So then my next question is, doesn't the current Oregon law provide for awarding of attorney's fees as they would in any other
right.
court suit so that it wouldn't need to be addressed in a bill of this nature?
Again,
no.
I'm unclear. I think it's
no.
unclear in
no.
general as to whether a suit brought under this specific statute would be eligible for attorney's fees.
Maybe I can ask the attorney on our staff.
I think you just responded.
I can respond a bit. I cannot cover every area where it
no,
speaks.
No, but if a case like this was taken to court, do our laws not deal with that already?
The answer, in my experience, from my knowledge of the statutes without going through them one by one, is no. Attorney's fees are only allowed where specifically described by statute and not otherwise. It's a general rule. And I am not aware of an Oregon state law in this kind of case, unless one goes to the unfair trade practices section, and I am not sure what provisions may overlap here. So it has to be, in response to your specific question, unless a statute speaks directly to the allowance of such fees, there is no such right.
John.
Tom,
you think it would be good to ask Leslie to counsel?
I think it would be good to ask a lawyer that isn't a politician the same question.
we have legislative counsel.
We will call on legislative counsel.
Okay,
counsel.
Thank you.
We will call Representative Lindquist.
Getting back to replacing the car, the other one, replacing the car with a comparable motor
vehicle.
Which
one you have before you?
I'm trying to get this all out.
Oh.
Okay, I'm comparing the two.
Okay.
7 says that it should be a new vehicle, and 6 says that it be a comparable vehicle. And I guess my question is, under both of them, doesn't the person have the choice? Okay, the decision is not totally by the manufacturer, by the
yes,
dealer.
Yes, that's correct.
So the person has the choice to say, if the vehicle you want to offer me as a comparable vehicle, in my view, is not comparable, I want my money back.
As I understand the third-party arbitration process, the third-party arbitrator will make a judgment as to what is equitable in a case-by-case basis. At that point, the consumer can then elect to accept the third party's
okay.
judgment or not.
Are sections 2 and 3 to the third party arbitration yet? Of the bill, sections 2 and 3. Have we gotten to the arbitration process under sections 2 and 3 of the bill?
The entire bill refers to
the
arbitration,
okay.
yes. Yeah, all the bill is eligible under the arbitration process.
Okay. And you're saying that he can either elect to accept it or not?
Yes, as the arbitration process is written in the federal code. Osprey feels it's important to clearly state that the consumer has the remedy to another new and unused motor vehicle, as opposed to potentially offering the consumer some sort of used vehicle as compensation for a defective new vehicle. That's our position on that wording.
I guess maybe when I think of a used vehicle, I'm thinking of something, you know, a couple of years old, and I understand
right.
a used vehicle can be one that I went out and bought a week ago and turned in.
Right.
However, I guess it just seems to me that a dealer or manufacturer would have to be crazy to kind of suggest that we'll replace this vehicle with something that's not even potentially comparable.
Well, without trying to editorialize too much, we recognize that in all probability, in the majority of cases, that would not happen. But we're just trying to ensure through the language that it cannot happen. We want to ensure that the consumer knows her or his rights and is able to have remedy for a new vehicle.
Okay. Okay, that's a good point.
Thank you.
Representative Bennett.
I'd like to go back to Section 6A for just 1 second, if I could.
Of which bill, sir?
Seven.
Seven's the one that has 6A in it.
Okay. Okay.
Again on that, would it be possible for you to, instead of asking a non-lawyer committee to look at that area of attorney's fees, could you possibly look at going to the Judiciary Committee and talking with them about an amendment, perhaps in the some addition to the Uniform Commercial Code? Would that be possible?
Yes, as a matter of fact, Representative Bennett, some of the early work we did on this bill, in working with a Willamette University law student, we had looked into the idea of placing this entire bill as part of the UCC as opposed to placing it in the Oregon statutes. Now, for whatever reason, that idea was not given a lot of, at that point anyway, was not given a lot of airtime. But we're still certainly very amenable to that idea.
We have legal counsel here, so we can...
We do have someone to ask.
Lou Littlehouse.
Yeah. You could come in. Maybe you can join the two there and...
Bob, can I ask him?
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Littlehouse, do you have a copy of HB 2793-7, page 4? Lines 1 to 3. Mm-hmm. Could that be better addressed in the UCC, perhaps, or could it be addressed there so that it's being dealt with by lawyers, that
or
question?
Is it? Or is it?
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Representative Bennett, my name is Louis Littlehill, Legislative Counsel's Office. Generally, there are no provisions in the UCC governing the attorney's fees. However, under Chapter 20, there are two provisions that govern, that relate to, and that permit attorney's fees to be charged, at least under the sales chapter of the UCC, Chapter 72. Under ORS 20, I think it's 096, attorney's fees are authorized in a contractual action, but only if the contract specifically provides for attorney's fees to the prevailing party. The attorney fees also are authorized in another section for the prevailing plaintiff, in certain cases, in an action on an express or implied warranty, only if the damages sought are less than $2,500. So in those two cases, contracts and a warranty under a contract, whether it's under the UCC or not, attorney's fees are already addressed.
So, Mr. Chairman, what you're saying then is Section 6A here, lines 1 through 3, have been addressed in law?
Not entirely.
Okay.
It's somewhat redundant, but not entirely. That is not redundant. There's some overlap, but not entirely. Under this attorney fees, for example, this section authorizes attorney's fees on an action on a contract generally, whether or not the car sales contract specifically authorizes attorney's fees. Okay, there is one difference. Second is that attorney's fees on an action on an express warranty, this would allow attorney's fees on an express warranty when the damages claimed are in excess of $2,500.
Okay.
Excuse
me, go ahead.
Then to cover this area, there would need to be some amendments drawn to some existing law, and that would be another process somewhere else if we didn't handle it here. Right. To cover what they're asking for, not that it's correct, just that's what they seem to be asking for, is full attorney's fees to a consumer.
Well,
or reasonable attorney's fees, rather.
Maybe I could go back up a bit. Under Oregon law, attorney's fees are authorized by statute somewhat on an ad hoc basis, not generally. the idea, I think, in providing attorney's fees was specifically to provide attorney's fees when the person exercises the remedy authorized here, and when the person goes to court, and really in no other case that is not on, not necessarily on other contractual basis, on another contractual basis. If you want a general attorney's fee provision on consumer contracts generally, then I suppose that would be, might well be better addressed in a separate bill.
Sure. Sounds like a good project for Osberg next year would be to go into that area rather than bill by bill, that maybe that whole question of attorney's fees for consumers could be addressed separately as a total issue where it does cover that. On page 2, line 3 of the number 6 amendments, which is your the comparable or new and used motor vehicle. You know the point? For, do you know where I'm?
Page.
It's the number 6 amendments, dash 6 amendments. And it says comparable motor vehicle there in line 3.
Line 3.
Mm-hmm. The replacement car. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? I'm talking to the Osberg people. I'm sorry. Could you, you had suggested, I believe, new and unused. Could you live with the wording that would make it just a new motor vehicle? Because of what the question unused might mean, would new be all right?
Could I refer that to Mr. Littlehales, as he may be maybe better able to answer if there is a legal difference between new
or comparable new?
Our concern, Representative Bennett, is that it be clear that the consumer has remedy, and that remedy being a comparable new motor vehicle. And as far as whatever the legal language on that, we can live with whatever legal language would give us that bad idea or that thought.
Mr. Chairman, would comparable then? That's the language that was in the dash 6 amendments, was comparable.
Yes.
That's fine then. Comparable's okay?
No, we think it's important to clearly state that the comparable vehicle be a new vehicle.
Okay.
As opposed to a used comparable vehicle. Jeez.
You can tell I've never bought a new car in my life.
I haven't either. Can I?
Following that right up, as I read the bills, there is a reasonable allowance for use attributable to the consumer for the first car, and that kind of counterbalances the request for new vehicle. In other words, the consumer would have to pay the reasonable worth of the use of the defective car as far as it went at the point in time the vehicle was replaced, whether by a comparable vehicle or under your wording, and I forgot it exactly, new and unused motor vehicle.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And the reasonable allowance is in both bills.
If I might just...
6 and 7 have this counterbalancing language on page 2 at line 10, on 6, on 7, and at line 9 on 6. It says a reasonable allowance for use is that amount directly attributable to use by the customer prior to the first report of nonconformity to the manufacturer.
Right.
So you have to pay for what you use up to the time that the car becomes defective.
Mr. Chairman, may I break in at this point? The reference to reasonable allowance for use, as I read the bill, applies, as I read it, to the case when the vehicle is returned, not when it's replaced. I'm not sure how you'd provide for compensation for reasonable use in the case of replacement. But if you note in subsection B, beginning on line 4, page 2, you accept refund, return of the vehicle, you refund the full purchase price, including certain costs, less a reasonable allowance for the consumer's use of the vehicle. And under subsection 2 deals with refunds. It doesn't doesn't refer to replacement. Hmm. Now, if you want some kind of provision for reasonable allowance for in the case of replacement, I think that could well be specifically addressed.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. I've said the final Jones first. And then
I think in referring to final counsel's comments, when we're talking about a comparable new and unused motor vehicle, if in fact it was determined that a replacement should be made in the arbitration process, then in the wording that you have, if the vehicle had been used for 11,000 miles,
right,
for example, there would be no provision with the wording that you have for anything to be determined regarding that usage if the replacement was determined. Correct?
No.
I mean, that's what you're attempting. Is that
right.
correct?
If I may.
Go ahead.
That if you're going to take that project on, that should be a larger project and maybe not even part of this bill. If you're going to be looking at that, because if you believe in that philosophy, then you're looking at all the laws in the state. And maybe that should be something dealt with in judiciary as far as what the needs are with the consumer, like Representative Jones brought up before.
The reason I think that there might be something to do, but I think that when you have I think the idea with this bill is to provide very clear standards. We must get a call a week from someone who has a car that's clearly a lemon. We tell the person we can't handle the case because you can't afford to.
You get a call a week from a lemon?
I
don't believe that.
Oh, I can, if I would document it, I could. Absolutely.
Well, okay, we have to go on with this bill, so you want to add some more to that?
Just a few things.
Because you almost have to use up your time.
One of the things on the attorney's fees, and I'll work backwards, on Version 7, there's an amendment, or Section 6A has been added, and that's for the attorney's fees. It's been our experience, and in our previous testimony, I alluded to the fact that my wife and I received over 2,000 telephone calls in about a 90-day period where we're unable to do anything to include Christmas shopping or try to build houses. I'm a home builder, or work in the National Guard. I'm a battalion commander. It's taken away all of our free time. Those calls were not limited to just diesel problems with GM diesels, nor to 200 series transmissions. We've had calls from people across the board that have had problems with their cars, from steering defects throughout. And I can verify that we're still getting at least one call a week with people that have defective automobiles that have not been able to engage attorneys or getting satisfactory recourse from the dealers. And the dealers are caught in the middle in this issue. And I'm not after the dealers. All we're really after is a product that will reasonably perform the mission for which it was intended for the amount of monies we spent. And we have not gotten that. The corporations are not being abused by the consumer in this issue. We feel that the consumers are being abused by large corporations, by their failure to address the product failures.
You have a question?
Yes, I do. Mr. Campbell, you were obviously at the hearing in transportation yesterday when we had the used car lemon bill. And at that point, we were told about the peer groups, the auto dealers, the new dealers have the groups where it's kind of their own arbitration board or whatever, and then the used dealers too. Do you ever refer any of these calls to those groups?
In some cases, well, quite frankly, I can't recall that I've ever referred anybody to the Better Business Bureau. No,
I'm not talking about the Better Business Bureau. I'm talking about their in-house organizations.
To AutoCap and that type of thing?
I guess that's the name of it. I'm not sure.
I have, what I have done is asked people if they've actually written letters to the manufacturer, called the manufacturer, and tried that recourse, because in some cases those things do solve the problem. And a matter of fact, we had a lady with an Olds Omega and about her third or fourth steering failure. The manufacturer's rep stepped in and made sure that it was fixed.
So then you've never referred them to the local groups that seem to have a pretty good percentage of responding
to
the claims?
To the Consumers Protection Agency?
No, I'm talking about the local groups. The dealer groups that we were told about yesterday, where you have a group and it's got a new car dealer, a used car dealer, a consumer, and I can't remember who else.
I'm sorry, Representative, I misunderstood your question. No, I have not done that. First of all, I was not aware of any of those things until yesterday.
It seems as though that would be a less costly way of dealing with it than going through the courts and things
but
they're
existing. Here we are in the middle of a process with General Motors, and I was not aware of very many of those remedies. So here I am, a knowledgeable person by this time, and I still don't know until those things were brought up in Thursday's testimony. So how would you expect somebody that's not involved in some hassle to really know what his remedies are? Most people do not know.
I guess I was executive director of an association, nothing to do with cars, and I was constantly getting calls from legal aid and a lot of other people saying, well, what does your association do to help these people? It would seem that if you were so involved, did you ever call the association and say, do you have anything, any remedies that you can, you know, your members are screwing up. Do you have any remedies that you as an association provide?
I did not. I bought the car from a GM dealer. I contacted the representatives from GM. I didn't feel it was necessary to get involved. Anybody else involved other than those folks that I felt responsible for the product.
In all the cases that I've seen, never has the dealer once told the...
Will you identify yourself with the
tape? Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. Gary Byrne. Never once has the dealer told the customer of that mechanism.
Well, I know, and I understand that,
yeah.
But we do have a group. Dieselgate is a well-organized group, and it seems that if I were going to organize a group to help consumers, I would know every option possible, right from picketing the place to everything else, you know. Getting to the bill, regarding the attorney fees, I thought the whole aim of this bill was to avoid going to court. Yet you said if we don't have the attorney fees in there, 90% of the people are not going to get new cars. And that's contradictory to the testimony that we had just a half hour ago that said 90% of the people have their situations handled through arbitration and don't end up in court.
I don't know that I said 90% of the people would not get satisfied. I think that the incentive would not be there, because the incentive is for the manufacturer just to delay the thing and hold off as long as they can. They go to court, then all they have to do is buy the car back. They can mass produce the cases, and the person waits and waits. If there's some incentive to resolve it, then it'll get resolved at an early stage.
Is there the opposite side of that coin? Is there an incentive for attorneys to go out to people and say, hey, yeah, let's take this to court. It's not going to cost you anything because your attorney fees are going to be paid. And then the attorney, the incentive is there for him to hold out for a bigger settlement.
I don't think so, because, quite frankly, when the biggest claim you're going to have is about $15,000, and there is very little way for the attorney to make money on that kind of thing. All this is enable the thing to be, the case to be brought, if there's an attorney willing to take it as a loser because he's interested in the kind of thing. And it makes the case possible, but in a $15,000 case or a $5,000 or $10,000 case, as a lot of these would be, you're just not going to have attorneys running out looking for that kind of case. And the attorney, if he can get the thing resolved at the beginning and get paid, you know, a couple hundred dollars by his client for handling the thing, he's going to do it that way rather than have, you know, $5,000 worth of time in the thing and get $15,000 for his client and $3,000 awarded by the court. I mean, I don't think that you're creating a situation where it's some kind of great boondoggle for the attorneys. It just permits the consumer's rights to be remedied. And let me just add,
Jones.
I'm sorry, I'm just going to have to back up and run through this one more time, because I understand that the way the arbitration process works
the manufacturer can't just say, I'm not going to give you the remedy that's been requested by the arbitration group.
It's not binding. Decisions of the mechanism of the arbitration from the federal rules are not binding on any person. The manufacturer is required to act in good faith, but the decision is not binding on the manufacturer. Plus, I don't think that that's a Chrysler. I think Chrysler might have this, might be susceptible to this arbitration procedure that's described in this bill. But I don't think Ford and General Motors even subscribe to this procedure.
Why do you think that? What I mean, is this just your own knowledge of what you think does or doesn't happen, or what?
The manufacturer has to elect to be covered under the Magnuson-Moss Act regulations. And quite frankly, I think General Motors and Ford just don't like it and don't want to be part of it. And I think that's indicative of how they're treating these kind of claims.
But I guess maybe we'd have to ask somebody from the manufacturer to testify in that regard as to whether they do or not.
Yeah, I think that, but that's my understanding. If I could add one other thing on the attorney's fees. Yeah. And on all these things that give it a very clear remedy. You're protecting the dealer by giving the consumer good remedies against the manufacturer. So if the consumer can bring the case and get attorney's fees from the manufacturer, if the manufacturer just stonewalls on the thing and doesn't pay a claim like he should, that's going to protect the dealer because the dealer doesn't have to ever even become part of it. It's not the dealer's responsibility to replace the cars. That's the manufacturer's problem.
Okay, we have to go on. Thank you for appearing.
Mr. Chairman, the points that Mr. Byrne made at excluding interest, or correction, on the new and unused and the conclusive, and the are in version 7, as well as the 30 more days rather than business days, are also in version 7. The one thing that was not in version, the two things that were not in version 7 was the exclusion of interest, and that was something that during our negotiation process over this bill to try to come to some agreement. I gave that away when I came back and reported to the rest of the people. I almost was burned in oil. The last thing was that's not in this was the provisions, the reasonable use that Mr. Byrne brought up is not in Section 7. So everything he brought up are in Version 7 with those two exceptions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have two more people to go here, Bill and Chris Gilmore. Is there anything that you want to add that's different from what we have heard already? Bill and Chris Gilmore, or what is that? Gilman?
Yeah,
Gilman. Is there anything new that we need to hear, or have we heard everything, or what is it?
We just want to testify as...
We know you're for the bill. For the amendments, possibly? Or?
No, we're just going to tell a story of what happened to us.
5 minutes each.
5 minutes together will probably do it.
Okay. We just celebrated our fifth anniversary of having a General Motors diesel wagon, and it's been absolutely a total nightmare. And hopefully with everything that's been discussed earlier, we'll get some kind of a positive remedy so this won't happen to consumers in the future. But the car that we purchased was listed at $11,500. We paid $9,100 for that particular car. And in 5 years, we've had $11,800 in repairs on that particular car, which has absolutely been a total nightmare for us. We are a one-income family, a one-car family. And it has just been a major disaster. We don't know from day to day if the car is going to run. As far as my wife and I have four children, as far as being able to take family outings or trips up to Seattle to see her folks, it's been totally put out because of the unreliable car. So we were totally frustrated. We tried writing to the zone office locally. We tried writing letters to the president of General Motors as well as Oldsmobile Division. Got zero results. And we were totally frustrated for 3.5 years until we got involved with Merle Campbell and other upset consumers that had similar type problems and formed our group. And it's a damn shame, I believe, in this country to have to pay that kind of money for a what you think is going to be a reliable type car and have to fight tooth and nails to get satisfaction. And we're not satisfied to this day. But hopefully, as we go down the road, we can put a man on the moon and send back a color picture in 10 seconds, but we can't take care of disgruntled consumers that have all the rights in the world when they make a valid purchase. With that, I think I'll turn it over to my wife. She is secretary of Dieselgate, and she can add a little to what I've said.
Well, the only thing I'd like to...
What identifies
my name is Chris Gilman. After our car had had two new engines put in it, we took it back to the dealer we bought it.
What car was it you said again? What kind of a car?
It was an Oldsmobile.
Oldsmobile.
It was an Oldsmobile. We took it back to the dealer that we purchased it from, and he refused to give us any trade-in value on that car, even though we had purchased it from him. So if there is a bill that can avoid having consumers deal with the dealer and having them go straight to the manufacturer who purchased that car, who should be responsible for the reliability of that car, then it is going to save a lot of problems for the dealers and for the consumers.
That's Jones.
Your testimony indicated, and I would just comment that I have in the past had difficulty with an automobile. Mine happened to be settled very well. My car was replaced by the manufacturer, and I didn't have to go through what you're going through. Mm-hmm. Let me just ask this question. You indicated that there had been nothing offered, or you had had no satisfaction in 3.5 years. See, to me, that sounds like frustration I couldn't live with for 3.5 years. But then you indicated that they had replaced the engine, I think, twice. So it sounds like something has been going on. Did you at any time request replacement of the vehicle?
Well,
or did you request refund of your money back there in the early stages of the car?
When the first new engine was put in the car, they charged us labor, but they did not charge us for the part.
How old was the car at that time?
The car was at 32,000 miles.
Which was out of warranty.
But I will say, previous to mm-hmm. this, the actual history of our car, they actually pulled the engine on our car when it was under, 5,000 miles because of oil leaks. I mean, it had been back to the dealer, I don't know, I mean, at least 10 times for oil leaks while it was still under warranty. Also, at least 10 times for alternator problems while it was still under warranty. And those things were never fixed. Now, by the time the engine actually blew at 32,000, if this Lemon Law would have been in effect, we would have had a new car by the time we'd had our car for 3 months. It would have been replaced.
No, it wouldn't. Well, 3 months if it had been in for 30 days,
four attempts to repair both the oil leaks and the alternator problems. It would have been.
The car has been down about 90 days in the 5 years for repairs. And that's not a gross exaggeration. I've got documentation to prove that. So we did ask for help with that first engine because we were quite shocked. The car was making a strange noise, and the dealership had our car for 38 days to repair the problem. And, of course, we didn't really have another car. They gave us alternate transportation for 2 or 3 days. The rest of the time we were without transportation. It was one of those things that just really developed into a major problem, and we were not in a financial position really to even pay for the labor. And they wouldn't even talk to us about, you know, working that out on a 90 to 120-day payback as far as the labor costs. But we had many problems after that, which I have written to General Motors and talked about, and we never got any positive results. The results started happening when we formed Dieselgate.
The letters would come in saying, we're going to look into this, and you'll get some satisfaction, and then we'd never hear from them. And that would come right from the president's office. We'd never hear from them again.
You never did go to the Better Business Bureau?
Oh, we went to talk to Russ, to the zone office, the people at the Oldsmobile zone office, and that kind of thing.
There's zone offices in Beaverton that are responsible for Oregon and Washington, and we had many, many conversations with the zone people about numerous problems. I was stuck in Seattle for 4.5 days about 2 years ago because of a defective starter. And, of course, I got back and forth with them, and they agreed to pay the actual cost of the starter, but not the labor.
How many miles did it have on it then?
For the starter?
Yeah.
I don't know. So far,
47,000 miles.
So far, right now, the car has close to 90,000 miles on it, and it has had three engines and three starters and four crankshafts and a number of alternators. And
$11,800 in repairs.
You just can't afford to say, hey, this is a bad car, it was a mistake. Let's just shove it off to another family, sell it used as long as the dealer won't take it, and go buy a new one. I mean, you just can't afford it.
What when you were going through all this with the dealer, and I know it was hard, you know, poor kids. What did the dealer tell you your avenues were?
They were still telling us that there was no general problem with the diesel engine, that we were the only ones that were experiencing this problem, and we had just happened to have gotten a bad car, and they knew it, you know. I mean, they knew our car was bad, but they kept charging us for it. They kind of gave us sympathy, but pay the bill.
Yeah. You know, the other thing about a diesel car, we got one of the first diesel wagons, I think, in the Portland area. In fact, it had been custom ordered, and the guy had canceled, and about that time I was ready to get into a car. We paid, I think, right around $800 premium for the diesel option. Mm-hmm. Now, in the Kelley Blue Book, if it's a diesel car, you take off around 12 and a half. So, I mean, there's no way you can win on these particular cars.
Well, that's the marketplace, though.
Well, I know it's the marketplace, but it's when you make a... I could have bought a Mercedes for what we've got invested in this car and what's been put in it in repairs, and it really isn't funny, you know.
Yeah,
but,
and there are about at least 1,000 or 1,500 other people in Oregon that have gone through the same thing we have. We're not the only ones.
Well, I have to tell you, I owned a diesel Seville and had nothing but great. I loved
it. We have heard of those.
And I got to put my own diesel.
Yeah. I should have bought a Cadillac.
We understand there is a problem, and we're up here not ignoring the fact that, yeah, we do have a problem, and there are a lot of people that have gotten stuck with this, and we're just trying to find out something that's going to help everybody avoid the most hassles, but still be workable and passable.
When our first engine went out, and we were stuck with what we felt was an enormous bill, we did go to a lawyer, and he said, hey, you can't fight General Motors. You can't. They're too big. You just don't fight them.
Mm-hmm. Listen, I've got a story. My water pump broke on I-5, and my car got stuck in the gas station for about 4 days. It got run into by an escaped convict from the state pen. And then the water pump cost me $400, and I never did get the money from the state pen to pay for it. So. It could
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Your
case.
We have this last one. Joe Zeman.
Jean.
Oh, okay, fine. Thank you. All right, so we have found it.
I'd like to ask, if I may, the representative from General Motors to respond to the fact that the arbitration is not a part of their process.
Mr. Austin, would you please come and respond to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Point of information with regard to that question on binding arbitration. With all due respect to Mr. Burns' legal background and so forth, I think he had defined, if he read the regulations, that the Code 703 of the Federal Trade Commission calls for it being binding on both parties. Now, both GM and Ford, the Better Business Bureau, AutoCap, and all the other programs are in the process of making sure that they comply, because the law says that they have to comply with the federal 703 provisions of the Federal Trade Commission. So that's one item. The other item is that we desire to have the arbitration binding on us and not binding on the consumer, because if he does want to go to court, he has a right to go to court and pursue it further. So. And by the way, I won't pursue any further. Any other questions?
Let me see if I understood, if I may.
the comment was made that Chrysler currently is using the arbitration process, but Ford and GM are not, and you represent GM. Is GM...
I represent all the manufacturers.
Oh, I'm sorry. Gee, okay. Is this true that Ford and GM are not using the arbitration process at this time, okay, or are they in the process, or what is... I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand.
The implementation of the third-party arbitration program was implemented by the industry on a voluntary basis some 4 years ago at key points throughout the country. Presently, all the manufacturers are participating in the binding arbitration program. They are making adjustments to comply with the federal regulations because part of the requirement in the proposed legislation is to comply with Part 703 of the Federal Trade Commission. So they are in the process of doing that. I do not know of a manufacturer in one form or another, either through their own program or through a contractor program like GM has with Better Business Bureau, that is not implementing the third party or utilizing the third party system.
Thank you. We're looking at copies of what appear to be the federal regulations, and it says decisions of the mechanism shall not be legally binding on any person. However, the warrantor shall act in good faith. And then it says, in any civil action arising out of a warranty obligation and relating to a matter considered by the mechanism, any decision of the mechanism shall be admissible. What that sounds like is not binding arbitration, but if someone is unable to enforce it, they may then enter courts to and have that admissible as a piece of the evidence in any court proceeding. And this is what we were supplied here today, which appear to be the federal regs. And that's consistent with what Mr. Byrne said, I believe.
Well, I haven't read the regs for a while, but I do believe that there's some place in there that says that it's binding on both parties.
Well, this is exactly the opposite.
Yeah, I know that's what you said. But the way the programs are set up, it is binding on the manufacturer.
Well...
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I move to amend. Are we in work session now?
Yes. We go to work session. We need to go to
work session. Okay. Okay. Oh, yeah, a couple.
Here we are. Hmm?
Okay. I would like to amend.
Go slow.
Okay.
Second
amendments, House Bill 2793-6. We'll just work with those.
Yeah.
That's what I'd like to. On line 3, page 2, change comparable to new.
Six. To scratch comparable. Insert new.
Yes. And... Yes, I'm sorry, delete comparable and replace it with the word new. And then on line 18, on page 3.
Three?
Yes.
Okay.
Insert, and this may need to be drafted, I apologize, I don't know how to, but it would be essentially arbitration shall be binding on the manufacturer. And then if it is in the federal law, it is. If it isn't, it is in ours. Let's make sure it's binding.
Arbitration shall be binding.
On the manufacturer. And that's it.
Was that on this?
That's a motion. That's a motion to amend those amendments.
Okay.
Yeah. Which still is.
Discussion.
It's not enforceable.
Any objections?
No problem.
You want to comment on it?
I'm not sure how the constitutional provision...
You identify yourself for the tape, so we know.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Louis Littlehales, Legislative Counsel's Office. I'm not sure how the provision under the Oregon Constitution requiring that in a civil that a person has a right to a jury trial, how that would affect mandatory binding arbitration
on the manufacturer.
On the manufacturer.
Why don't you check that, and if it doesn't work, perhaps it shouldn't be there. Let's turn this over to Legislative Council and let them figure it out.
I think that's...
The manufacturer could choose not to participate in the arbitration process, though, could they not? No.
But if they go to it, it could then be binding.
Well, they're going to have to.
Some arbitrations...
Yeah, binding. Once into it, they consent to binding arbitration.
This may be...
Do you want to comment on it, Jim?
No, I was just handling it.
Okay. I'm wrong. I turned it around. I think originally...
Okay, why don't we leave it up to Legislative Council to look at that language?
Right.
Okay. So, can we adopt it conceptually?
Yeah.
What do you want to do?
Okay,
you adopt conceptually what you want to do, and Legislative Council look at the language that needs to be inserted here. Okay. Okay. So, comments?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hannah.
I move that we amend HB 2793-6.
We had a motion
on the floor.
Oh, I'm sorry. Haven't you adopted that?
Not yet.
Oh, excuse me.
So we have to... We have the motion of Representative Bannon before us that would delete on page 2. Line 3, compatible and insert new. And what was the second one, Representative Bennett?
Nope.
I think this was the only one, right?
Page 3.
At page 3, the adoption, arbitration. At least adopt conceptually
the binding arbitration.
The binding arbitration and leave it up to the Legislative Council to come up with language. Right?
I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention.
So those two.
Question of Representative Bennett.
Yes.
The binding arbitration is binding on both parties, one party, or who?
The amendment as stated, Representative Hanlon, was arbitration shall be binding on the manufacturer.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Further discussion? Objections? No? Motion passed. Representative Hanlon.
Mr. Chair, I move to amend 2793-6 by inserting a section 6A as it appears.